Right,
Perfect.
screen.
Also, the speaker today, Tillman, is a former colleague of Katarina in Edinburgh. Tillman started the undergraduate studies at ATH in Zurich. Then he did the postdoc in University of British Columbia until moving to Edinburgh several years ago with a Marie Curie Fellowship. More recently, he got a Leverhulme Fellowship. And I just got that he's soon moving back to ATH. Tino, when you can start, I invite people as usual to interrupt the speaker at any time and ask questions. Please.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Right, so I'll just start in. So I'll start with a quite general overview of the background. If everyone is familiar with the things, please shout. Right, so I'll talk a bit about the trend analysis we did with the K1000 gravitational lensing and TSZ effect. It's a project that started way back when, actually during my PhD still, that has just lingered for various reasons over the years. But last fall, we finally got around finishing that up. So just going through a title, gravitational lensing. So the image I like to show for this is, in gravitational lensing, we're trying to infer what the surface of a pool looks like just by looking at the distortions and spirals of light at the bottom of a pool. Like, you can't see the surface of the water, but you see how the light gets distorted and deflected. And from that, you can infer what the water surface looks like. Now, in practice, we don't look into pools. We look into the sky. And here, the image you can think of is if you have a faraway galaxy, like a spiral galaxy that you look face on. So if there were no distortions going on, then you would see a round shape, a circle. But as the light passes along foreground distributions of mass, then that light gets deflected and that image of this circle background galaxy gets distorted into ellipses. And by looking at how these distortions happen coherently over larger scales, we can infer on what this foreground distribution of matter is that we can't see in the case of dark matter or just general non-luminous matter. Now, in practice, one say statistic we use to measure this gravitational lensing effect is called cosmic shear, which is the correlation between galaxy shapes, and it has a nice property that it probes the distribution of all matter that is in the universe, so including dark matter. So going back to the previous picture, if you have your distorted galaxy shapes that you measure, then you just measure the correlation between the galaxy ellipticities and do it for all the pairs in your survey. So you have one here, it's those two, and so on. And if you do that for all your galaxy pairs, then this two-point correlation function tells you something about the clustering of the matter distribution that sits in front of these galaxies whose images get distorted. Now, I'll talk a lot about CL, so this is the angular correlation, angular power spectra, just to get an intuition on how a specific angular power spectrum corresponds to how the clustering or the field is measured on. This emission here, so if you have a flat power spectrum, then it's basically white noise. As you increase the power in large scales, you see that you see more large scale structure appear, and vice versa. As you get more small scale power, so high multiples, the more fine grained essentially the structures become. And in practice, it doesn't go beyond like flat white noise. There's some special cases where you have even more power small scales, but it's very rarely happen in the data we look at. Any questions so far for this background? All right, then moving on to the K1000 part. So KIDS, that stands for the KiloDQ survey. That is a wide field galaxy service at the VST. The analysis I talk about includes thousand square degrees. So we're finally doing the KiloDQ part of the name justice. It's not entirely the full survey yet. It will be a bit more, but it was the last major data release we did. Currently includes about 21 million galaxies. And what sets KIDS apart from the other stage 3 surveys like DES or HSC is that we have full overlap with Viking, which is an infrared survey. So we have full near infrared coverage and 9 photometric bands for all our galaxies, which help us estimate the photometric redshifts, which is one of the major, if not the main, systematic uncertainties current with cleansing surveys. Give you an idea on where it is on the sky. So KIDS is divided in two narrow patches, one in the north that overlaps with BOSS and one in the south that has overlap with another spectroscopic survey that was specifically designed to mimic the BOSS selection but overlap with KIDS. So you have spectroscopic overlap everywhere. That's not too much for the work I showed here, but was part of the bigger overall KIDS 1000 cosmology analysis, or with the 3x2-point analysis with spectroscopic clustering from BOSS. Then, because we have this very good, or we have at least hopefully very good photometric estimates. Or calibrated redshift distributions, we split our galaxy sample up into 5 tomographic bins. So bins in redshift, which is shown here at the top. And this allows us essentially to probe how structure grows over time in redshift. So galaxies are further away or distorted by more stuff in between. So you have more lensing there unless you go to redshift bins that are closer to us, I guess, have less of a lensing effect. And finally, this is now what we measured. So this is the angular power spectrum. So the CL, I showed that animation just a bit earlier for the different redshift combinations in KIDS. We have the first source bin, you are very close to the observer, so there's not much lensing going on, so there's not much signal. And if you go to higher redshifts, you get quite a strong signal. And then all the different cross correlations between the spins, because all of the further away bins also measure met distribution that includes the closer bins. Now, if we take this measurement and then try to infer the cosmology that best fits that, including all nuisance parameters like count of uncertainties in the photometric redshift calibration, intrinsic alignment, baryonic feedback, and so on. And these are our cosmology results. So you get this narrow banana from cosmic shear. It's basically shown here the parameters of sigma 8 is how clumpy matter is, and omega m, how much matter there is. And because lensing constant distinguish between if there's lots of matter or if it's just not as much matter but very clumpy, you have this degeneracy. But across this degeneracy, it's measured by a parameter called S8, which you might have heard of. This gives quite strong results. And just to give an idea on how this parameter space in red here are the Planck primary CMB constraints. And the lensing sits about 2 to 3 sigma tension there, depending on how you want to measure that. So that's basically the KIDS 1000 cosmic shear quick overview. There was a whole lot of papers where we looked at that in detail. If you want to dig down there in more detail. Any questions so far? Moving on. So I mentioned that cosmic shear probes the distribution of all matter. Oh, that only means dark matter, but also normal baryonic matter, mostly just the cosmic ionized gas. And this is where the problems start. So if you go to simulators and ask them, please simulate me the universe and tell me how matter is distributed or clustered. So what is the matter power spectrum? Then you can get, or until relatively recently, you could get quite different answers depending on which simulation group or suite you asked. So as shown here is the ratio between a matter power spectrum that includes baryons, so includes galaxy formation, supernova feedback, HN feedback, and so on, and a power spectrum that has all matter as dark matter, so gravity only. See, most simulations predict the suppression of power at small scales, essentially because HN feedback blows gas out of small to medium-sized halos and thus suppresses its power, which is a problem for gravitational lensing because we're exactly sensitive to this quantity, including these scales. So knowing which of these predictions we actually should use in VR cosmology is important. And until I said quite recently, there was really a poor understanding on where these differences are coming from. Now, to try to get at the bottom of this, our hope was we could try to give observational data to help decide which of the simulation to use as a theory model. Now, one reason these are so different is that, well, gravity is quite well understood in a sense, and as shown on the left, it's just the dark matter part of a simulation, and there we just have almost serene gravitational collapse. Everything is like nice and controlled in a sense. On the right side, you have the gas temperature where you have veritable fiber basically going off from supermassive black holes, blowing out gas, and so on. Now, we don't actually need for our purposes to get all the dynamics of this stuff that's going on here on the right. We just need to know where the gas ends up to get a prediction for our power spectra. So the idea behind the project was we use what's called the thermal linear Celtic effect to map out where the gas is. And then because we have gravitational lensing, which measures where all the matter is, and we hopefully by combining the two, we can learn something on how the gas is distributed and from that, what the matter power spectrum looks like. So the thermal linear Celtic effect comes about when you have low energy photons that come from the CMB. And as they travel throughout the universe with the observer, they can get Compton or inverse Compton scattered by free energetic electrons. And that causes a shift in the CMB spectrum. So if you look towards a cluster, for example, you see the CMB's black body spectrum slightly shifted to higher energies, so to higher frequencies, because some of the photons get as it's scattered away from the free ionized gas in the cluster. That allows us to map out where the free electrons are, which basically are today's all electrons or the corresponding gas, because it's ionized mostly. So in terms of what we actually measured, it's going back to the similar picture we showed before. We have our background galaxies that get distorted from gravitational lensing, and then we have our foreground mass distribution. But because we know it's not just dark matter, it's also ionized gas, then that we can map out with the thermal linear effect. We can measure the correlation between this TSZ effect that maps the gas and our distorted background galaxies, the gravitational lensing, and then from that try to infer what this correlation tells us about the gas distribution. That's just basically what I said just now. Right. Now to the actual data. So we have essentially two data sets. One is from Planck. So this is a full sky data set that has a lot of frequency coverage. We have a number of different set maps with different map construction algorithms where you can look at how these affect our results. The one downside is that the Planck beam at 10 arcmins is quite large. So you can't resolve actual individual halos and the gas distribution therein. On the other hand, we have the Akatama Cosmology Telescope, which is a ground-based CMB experiment. At the moment, the data set we had available from that only had partial overlap with one of the KITS fields. So the overlap region is quite small compared to what we have with Planck. And it basically combines the ECT data, which is only a couple of frequency bands with high resolution, with the Planck data at higher frequencies that have a quite wide frequency coverage. And because it has a quite small beam, in principle, it gives us a much higher angular resolution to really probe small scale physics. In this case, we actually didn't end up using that. But in principle, if you want to look into these effects at small scales, ECT is clearly preferable over the Planck data. Now going back to our measurement we did, so this is the cross correlation between the KITS 1000 lensing and the Planck TSS data. So again, showing the angular power spectrum shown here, as you can see, again, in the five tomographic bins, the correlation over the different redshifts. We have quite nice signal at the higher redshifts. So we have about a 9 sigma detection of the discuss correlation. So we could start trying to actually get information out of that instead of just detecting that such a correlation exists. Any questions so far? All right, good. So what's shown here is the measurement. Also in blue, the best fit model. Now the modeling turned out to be one of the most challenging parts of this project. And the reason is that there was really no good model for this kind of thrust correlation back when it started. So I said, this is 2-point measurement. So the underlying three-dimensional quantity that we try to infer about is the power spectrum. So the 3D power spectrum. And if you just care about the 3D power spectrum for gravity only or dark matter, and there are many applications by now that are quite accurate. So you can use emulators over high resolution n-body simulations, can use more physical based model like halo fit and its derivatives. So by now, if you just care about dark matter, there are lots of options that are very accurate. But obviously the universe doesn't consists only of dark matter. If you want a power spectrum that accounts for all matter, then there are some options. So things like HMCode that try to account for variance, or very logical approaches like they just decompose simulation power spectrum with the PCA approach, for example. So there's some ways to go about this. But what we need for our cross-correlation between gravitational lensing and the set effect is the cross power spectrum between matter and electron pressure, because that's the underlying field that sources the SZ effect. And there are really no good options back when we started this project. So there are, or when what people did is they just took the naive halo model, had independent profiles for matter and pressure, like an NFW profile and some universal pressure profile. And it comes with all the downsides of the naive halo model, like the poor accuracy in the transition regime between the one and two halo terms. And because the matter and the pressure profiles didn't talk to each other, you couldn't really make a consistent inference, because if you said you somehow couple or calibrate your your matter profile to some simulation to account for baryonic feedback. You do the same for the pressure profiles. Then because those profiles don't talk to each other, if you just, you could crank up or bloat up halos in the matter from some agent feedback, but the pressure wouldn't know about this. So you wanted a model that had these parameters coupled. So if you tuned that the matter profiles, for example, the pressure profile would adjust accordingly. So we came up with a model. So mostly that this work by Alexander Mead, which is a halo model-based approach where we have separate components for dark matter, gas, and star components. And then while all these different profiles are independent, we use the Bahamas hydrodynamical simulations, which have been run at different agent feedback strengths. And then at each feedback strength, we calibrate the best fitting profiles. And then because we have these fits at different feedback strengths, we can create a model that has only a single parameter, which is the feedback strength that allows us to interpolate over baryonic feedback essentially, and have the different model components adjust accordingly. So basically you have a single knob, which has the, it's called this HN temperature, which is a subgrid parameter in Bahamas that allows us to scale our whole model for the matter pressure power spectrum, or just the matter power spectrum with just this one component. And then it's using something called direction formalism, where you basically, instead of predicting the power spectrum directly with the halo model, you predict a naive halo model with your quantity, like the matter cross pressure, for example, and divide that by a naive halo model of a dark matter only power spectrum. And by taking a ratio, you basically cancel out the halo model inaccuracies, and then you multiply that ratio with an accurate model you have of the dark matter only power spectrum, for example, from some emulator. And together that gives much more accurate predictions than just the halo model directly by itself. Any questions on the modeling so far?
Yes, I am. You're using Bahamas simulations, and as you know, as you said before, the modeling strongly depends on the recipes you're using to model the hydrodynamics part. How are you dealing with your conclusions with respect to this point?
It's a good point. Yeah, we only did it on Bahamas, mostly back then when we did it, they were the only ones that actually have the necessary volume. I think they're still the biggest one in terms of volume. So we really need it, because it's like a large structure cosmology measurement we do. We need these large boxes. And back then, Bahamas was the only one that actually varied the feedback strengths. So I can completely agree, and it's also one of my conclusions that should be repeated with different modern simulation suites and look at how things vary. But back then, Bahamas was the only one that did what we needed to do. Right. Okay, so we have our measurement and our best fit model. As I said, that this model is parameterized by this agent feedback temperature parameter, which is actually how strong agent feedback is. And as you vary this feedback parameter, the model prediction changes, so we can use our measurement to try to constrain this parameter now, which is what we set out to do. But because we now have quite a nice measurement, and this whole model is based on a halo model, we can also change the cosmological parameters. So if you change, for example, sigma 8, get quite a strong effect basically because that set effect is very sensitive to sigma 8. The reason being that it's very sensitive to how many big halos there are, because it's the main contribution to the SZ power spectrum. And in turn, the number of massive halos strongly depends on this sigma 8 parameter. Or you can change omega m as well. So we did a basically full-blown cosmology analysis. So we vary here the feedback strength parameter, but also all cosmology parameters that we vary in kits, as well as all the other systematic parameters we used in kits on cells. So this includes marginalizing over uncertainty in the redshift distribution, intrinsic alignment, and so on. And see, we get some cosmology constraints, which was a nice thing to see. Now the signal basically scales as sigma 8 to the fifth power times omega m. So this is quite a bit stronger sigma 8 dependence than cosmic shear. We still have a degeneracy between omega m and sigma 8, so the more matter, the less clump it needs to be, essentially. But it's not as strongly degeneracy as in cosmic shear, so instead of a cosmic banana, that's basically more like a cosmic potato or something. And to give you an idea on how this sits in the overall parameter space here, again, it's the Planck contours. And you see it's sitting a bit lower again. Now that because the uncertainties are larger, the significance isn't too big. And because the modeling really pushes, or this application of our model really pushes the model a bit to its breaking point, we don't go too much into depth on what that means, but in general, it goes with the same trend that it sits lower on this parameter space than Planck. Now to the last part of the title, the trend analysis between kits and cells and a set effect. So it is so far, I showed you just the cosmic shear results and just the cross-correlation results. But obviously we have both and they're correlated. So again, this is our cross-correlation between SZ and lensing, and the bottom is the cosmic shear. So the correlation of gravitational lensing is itself. And we thought, well, we have such a nice measurement, why not combine the two? Because as I said before, we have this cosmic potato from the cross-correlation and a very sharp cosmic shear constraint, so they intersect. So we can try to break these two degeneracies to get that cosmological constraints. So having our measurement, we obviously need a account for the fact that these two measurements are correlated, because both, well, they measure the same logical structure, and the lensing part is the same for both anyways. So we compute a covariance for each part individually, obviously, but also the joint covariance between those. And in technical terms, that's an analytic covariance. So we use a master for our measurement, which is a master-like algorithm to measure the TDCLs. But it also accounts for the full mode mixing and partial sky terms in the covariance. It's quite a nasty setup. So there's account basically for the Gaussian covariance, and then you also account for super sample covariance. So the fact that we have only part of the sky that we observe, and large modes on the size of the survey can affect how the overall signal looks like. So you can imagine if you sit in an overdensity, then the measured statistics look different than you sit in a big underdensity. And then the connected non-Gaussian term, which basically just accounts for the fact that locally we have clearly non-linear structure formation going on. Just give an idea on how this looks like. So in the top left corner, you have the cosmic shear covariance, which in the power spectrum is quite diagonal, with off diagonals here being the correlation between the different redshift bins. And the bottom right, you have the cross-correlation covariance. We have quite strong off-diagonal terms, basically because you have very strong one-halo term in the tri-spectrum. which causes that these correlations between multiples. Now that we have our measurement and our covariance, we can combine our constraints. So we have, again, our cosmic shear constraints, our cross-correlation constraints. And when we combine them, you get this nice combination. Again, to give you an idea where Planck sits. Now, in terms of tension, that doesn't really change too much. The main reason being that what drives the tension with Planck sensing is the cosmic shear. So this direction here, this S8 direction. And whenever you combine essentially any other probe with cosmic shear, you just cut this thin degeneracy and don't really change the distance across, because that's already very well constrained by cosmic shear. But it does give you a better handle on sigma 8 and omega m by themselves. Now to the actual baryonic feedback parameter we set out to measure. This is the marginal constraint on that. So in blue, you have just cosmic shear by itself. The reason there's no effect on that is because the scale cuts we use in KITS 1000, we choose specifically, so we're not sensitive to baryonic feedback or limit sensitivity to it, because there's still quite a lot of uncertainty. Now, because we did a joint analysis, or we wanted to do a joint analysis, we decided to use the same scale cuts also for the cross-correlation measurement, because the whole KITS 1000 machinery was validated for the specific scale cut, and doing it for anything else would have required to redoing the whole validation. And because I did a project after spending 2 years basically just doing that validation, I didn't feel like redoing everything again was a good use of my time. So we just went with a very conservative choice for the scale cuts, which admittedly shoots ourselves a bit in the foot, because basically all the baryonic feedback that we want to constrain or be cut out to a large degree. So that's why the constraints from just the cross correlation sits at, it's still quite wide, has a peak that's a bit more defined than just cosmic shear itself, but it's really not as constraining as we had originally hoped. But again, that's by design, because we basically cut out scales that are sensitive to baryonic feedback. And for the joint constraints, those are still a bit better than shear by itself again. And it sits basically right on top of what the Bahamas say the feedback should be, is given by this 2-grain line, the range. And just to remind you, Bahamas was calibrated such that the feedback was calibrated such at range that you recover the gas fractions in groups and galaxy groups, as well as have the right galaxy stellar mass function. So there is a reason why Bahamas thinks that feedback range is what it should be, and we happen to land right on top. So there was someone ever comforting that we didn't end up in a completely weird part of parameter space. So just as a summary now, we found that you can use these cross-correlation between a set and cosmic and gravitational lensing. These cross-correlations give information on both cosmology and baryonic feedback if you account for that properly in your modeling. If you combine that with cosmic shear, then that allows you to break the degeneracies that both of these probes have and give quite tight constraints. But going further, the modeling needs more work. As if that was our first shot at it, but as you said, that should be calibrated on a wider range of simulations. At the moment, we extrapolate quite a bit outside of the feedback range that Bahamas has, which to a certain degree is okay because it's a physical model, but the amount we're pushing it is probably a bit more than this would be good if you really care about very robust constraints. This work was more of a proof of concept, but I think hopefully prove that the concept at least works. Thank you.
Thank you, Tillman, for Very, very nice and clear talk. Actually, if you can send to at least to me your very first slide with the simulations of the cosmic shear maps while changing the movie, changing the slope, I would use it for my class of data analysis the last year students. So it would be really nice.
For sure.
I have a question, but if no one else, well, I start. I take the opportunity of my role. I'm curious, when you show the plot of the cross correlation between shear and then the SZ, in particular, the panel showing the cross correlation between the third shear tomographic beam and Y. Well, okay, that's fine. Also S2Y, but especially S3Y, there seem that data, pseudo-CL, shows a sharp feature. Do you explain it somehow, also present in S2? Well, S1, there's only one. Do you explain it somehow? And which is the redshift range concerning S3?
No. It's... I chalk it up to noise. I mean, it sits within the posterior predicted distribution, so it sits within the range you would expect the data to scatter around.
Okay, so you're not very concerned by this sharp. I mean, all the others seems to show a smooth trend.
Yeah, so I mean, the data points are correlated because of the trispectrum, but again, this is a model-dependent statement to a degree. So. Mm-hmm. You would expect less scatter than in cosmic shear, for example, but it's still...
Which is Sorry? Which is the redshift range of S2 and S3?
The 0.3 to 0.5, 0.5 to 0.7. Okay. So anything below that.
Okay. Thank you. Katharina, please.
Thanks, Tilman, for this interesting talk. So I have a question that is related to the very last part, which is the constraints on the feedback, AGN feedback. So I'm not very familiar with the implementation of the AGN feedback in Bahamas simulations, but could you just give a little bit more details on what exactly, physically speaking, what physical process is constrained by this parameter? I mean, what part of the, because as you know, implementation of the AGN feedback is complicated. There are several components of it. So what does it physically encapsulate, like this parameter? What can you constrain physically speaking in terms of galaxy evolution?
Right, yeah. So as I say, it's a subgrid parameter. So I mean, the Bahamas is the same code basically as like the Eagles lineage. So Eagles, Owls, Cosmo Owls, Bahamas, and so on. So my understanding is it measures the amount of that black hole accretes till you reach that AGN temperature, and then the energy gets injected in the surrounding medium. It's a measure of how much energy gets injected, essentially.
Okay, so basically, like, what fraction of the energy is injected isotropically?
Yeah, I haven't looked at it in a while, but I think, yeah, it accretes till it reaches that temperature, and then it dumps everything. So,
because then it could be interesting to, I mean, if you can compare, which is not obvious that it's easy and possible, but then in principle we could compare the range of the estimated parameter with other implementations to see whether there is another one code that is able to reproduce or that falls within this range. So it could be interesting.
Yeah. So my thing is there's a push to move away from this parameter. So they found that if you look, only care about the power spectrum, then you have this very tight relationship between the suppression of power. So this is this measures the suppression of power at k of 0.5 later on megaparsec. If you plot these different simulations, so that's basically the plot I showed before, but parameterizes in the baryon fractions in group-sized halos, then you have this very tight relationship between the suppression of power and the gas fraction, which is a quantity you can measure directly. So my understanding is the push is now to a parameterize the simulations in this parameter. Because then you have a parameter that's clearly has a fiscal meaning instead of just some separate parameter. And it also is very strongly correlated to the quantity we care about, which is the metaparsec suppression, which is maybe less useful if you care about galaxy formation, but just from a cosmology radiation lensing perspective, that seems to be the way to go.
Okay, thank you.
Any other question or comment? I actually have another one. At the level of accuracy pushed by current lensing data and forthcoming lensing data, how much relevant is the modeling of the CNB foregrounds, or the CIB, and of the masks?
I mean, for the lensing, dosings don't matter. Are you talking about this cross correlation I showed?
Yeah,
here?
Sure.
Right. So I didn't. Sure. So we looked into the CIB contamination, because that's one of the main things that come up in these cross correlations. What we saw it like many years ago, was like, well, CIB is at high redshift. Our gravitational lensing sources are comparatively low redshift, so you don't have to worry about it. But it turns out if you take the cross correlation between the lensing and the CIB maps, you get actually a very nice signal. It's significant that it's about as good, if not better, than the cross correlation with the set effect. So clearly there is something we should worry about it. But what we did in our case, we took a very simple model. So we assumed that the CIB just gets transmitted linearly into the Compton Y map. So the measure of the set effect, which first order is okay in detail, because modern map reconstruction use fancy linear combinations. It's not just a simple linear combination, but I think the first order is good enough. So the contamination to our cross correlation is also linear. And this quantity here, so this is the cross correlation between the shear and the CIB, is the plot I just showed here. Now the transmission parameter here, you can estimate by looking at the autocorrelation of the CIB, the cross correlation of CIB on the Z map, and the autocorrelation of the Z map. And then if we take that and marginalize over the uncertainty on that, we found that it makes X seem no difference to our constraints. But it's shown here at the top. So orange is again what I showed before. If that includes the CIB marginalization, if you don't account for the CIB marginalization, you get the red contours, which basically sit right on top. And the other lines, especially the brown and pink ones, are if you try to subtract the CIB at a map level instead of marginalizing out. Mm-hmm. And again, doesn't change the overall picture. With ACTIS, it's a bit different, but we dug down a bit and we found that there's just something weird going on and there's no component deprojected. So there are two data points that lie completely out of where they should be, which causes these wide excursions to low sigma 8. But because we didn't make the ACT maps ourselves, we couldn't really code down and try to debug the map construction pipeline.
Thank you so much. Other questions or comment? No? Well, if no, thank you. Thank you again, Tilma. for next week. We didn't schedule